sometimes when I'm in certain frames of mind, particularly on very hot days around the North Circular, I can feel time radiating off of pre-moulded concrete lintels.
Welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography with John Rogers and Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that looks at the rich tradition of early 20th century topographical walking guides to London and the South East and what use they might be to us today.
They're kind of like inlet valves for some unmediated cosmic energy.
Each week, we'll be taking a trip through the pages of a different book as if we are on a wayward topographical ramble.
Because I know they're actually just technology, they're applied machinery, but they seem to me almost to be kind of like storage vats of regional memory.
Hello, and welcome to Ventures and Adventures in Topography on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, John Rogers, and my co-host, Nick Papadimitriou. This is a show that explores the world of early 20th century walking guides to London and the South East.
And this week, we're exploring the face of London with Harold P. Clun.
The face of London, Harold P. Clun. Another notable aspect of the London scene is the continual intensification of traffic on the roads, though new roads and more flyovers and underpasses have done much to smooth the path of the motor vehicle. But for the pedestrian, and it is to the pedestrian that the following 25 walks are addressed, life is becoming rather less comfortable, for he is gradually being pushed underground into subways or up above onto podia, pedways, walkways and the like to get him out of the way. Most of these above or below schemes for the protection of the pedestrian, who once had priority on the roads, involve the ascent and descent of varying numbers of steps, and it is pathetic to see elderly people struggling up 29 steps out of a subway at Hammersmith Broadway. As a further humiliation, there are several places where foot passengers, like animals in the zoo, are penned in to the pavement by long lengths of metal railings, lest they should attempt to cross the road. These various protective devices have been well described as safety with indignity.
That was Hayley LaPaine reading from The Face of London by Harold P. Clun. What would we say first about this book? Probably the pronunciation, because we've been disagreeing about the pronunciation of his name, Clun, Clon, Clun, haven't we, Nick, all day on the walk?
It's been a ferocious debate between us, John. And I noticed at the beginning of this programme, I pronounced his name as Clun, and you just pronounced him as Clun, which is the reverse of our usual positions. Interestingly, I noticed that you pronounced my name Papadimitriou in the reading at the
beginning.
Which
is correct.
It is, in fact, Papadimitriou, and I find it deeply inappropriate and offensive that you should mispronounce my name.
The show's been on air, not 2 minutes, and the first digs are in. I suppose we should talk about this book. It is, after all, what we are here to do. A wonderful book. And the first thing I'm going to say about it is a very banal observation, but it is a show about walking books. And this is a monster of a book, isn't it? It's about 600 pages. That is not made to be taken out on a walk, although we both did take copies of it with us when we did a walk on Sunday for the show. How would we best describe Harold P. Clun's The Face of London, which you think is first published in
1932. I was very surprised because in the first programme in this series I corrected you and said that it was actually published in 1952, just the first of many mistakes I've made in this series. The first edition was 1932. I have a 1957 edition here on the desk, and John over there has the 1970 edition with the notorious swinging London dust jacket, which, given the moment later on in the programme, I may get a chance to describe. Yeah, it is a fat book, and it's not really made for the rucksack. Interestingly, though, I would say it was a very popular book because, of course, you go into junk shops, second-hand shops, you very, very often see copies of one edition or another.
Yeah, I've seen two in the last week. I think there is one currently residing in that little second-hand bookshop in Flask Walk in Hampstead, is there at the moment. It is a book, though, which is available. And like a lot of the books that we've been talking about, this has been through several editions, as you say. And I think maybe one reason for that is it's, in a way, Nick, I think this is one of the least idiosyncratic books, in a way. It's one that's, it's like an inventory of places loosely laid out in a kind of linear route, but not as prescriptive as some of the other books that we've been looking at in the series, don't you think?
Well, I think that Clun is inadvertently idiosyncratic. He is deeply objective. He describes what he calls walks along the streets of London, describing all the architecture that he sees and a little bit about the history of the areas that he passes through. But I would say that Clun is twisted with accuracy. And like a lot of people who want to pin everything down and be very specific, he comes across as being a borderline psychopath on occasion. Perhaps I'm overstating the case slightly.
I think
the book inadvertently reads as odd for people like you and I, John, who have passed through psychogeography in a much more kind of subjectivized culture, because his deep objectivity is strange in its impact on me. I find his descriptions of the city cold and frightening, I think, really.
Really? Well, why frightening?
He was, I believe, architecture and town planning expert for the Times.
Right.
And he's very, very focused on the buildings and the thoroughfares and the parks and the fine old houses and the institutional buildings of London. And because he's an architect, he often, between the various editions, bemoans the changes that have taken place architecturally in Britain. For instance, between 1932 and 1957, you have the big issue of the Blitz.
That's right, the London Marches On. He talks about that. That was one of his books, wasn't it? London Marches On, records of the changes that have taken place in the metropolis.
That's right. But because he's, although he ostensibly looks at change, because buildings change far less slowly then the daily flow of the human matter of the city, what you have is this sense of the concrete city of the buildings, the things you see as you walk along the street. People don't seem to be of much interest to him. They're merely the ants running around the termite mound, and it's the termite mound that he's interested in. Perhaps I should say the termites running around the termite mound.
I think what we found, actually, revisiting this book for the purposes of this show, where we are sort of obliged in a way to see where he fits in and how useful he is as a tool, as a guide, because I suppose, you know, we are talking about a practice of topographics and a practice of topography. One thing that I thought about Clun was that it reminded me a little bit of what I'd read about Sir John Stowe, the Elizabethan antiquarian and the person who's sort of credited with pioneering the idea of topographical history, or I should say historical topography. And the idea there was that he would literally create lists and inventories of the buildings that existed in Elizabethan London, and down to quite a fine sort of architectural detail and streets and street names and what shops and businesses existed there. And that all that would create would be a framework for people to do with as they wish. That was a practice that was meant to be distinct from narrative history, which obviously was very in vogue at that time and still, you'd say, is very much in vogue now. But and Clun, for me, is almost in that tradition of logging and listing and collecting the city as it exists at this particular moment in time.
I do think, though, with Clun, that his deep objectivity is strange to the senses, and as I say again, particularly to someone from our generation who perhaps have read Ian Sinclair or writers like that. I don't really have a lot else to say right now.
I was just realised.
You better.
Let's play. Well, I haven't. I'm going to let Clun speak now. This is another reading from The Face of London by Harold P. Clun.
To the north of Finsbury Park lies the extensive district of Hornsey, which is almost entirely a product of the last 70 years. Until 1870, few villages near London had retained so rural a character as Hornsey. It now includes the populous suburbs of Crouch End and Muswell Hill within its municipal area. The population, which in 1881 was only 5,673, had increased by 1951 to 97,600. In 1816, it was described as a pleasant village 5 miles from London, through which the New River flows, and as a favourite resort of its good citizens. The parish church lies at some distance from the old village in a valley, now covered with houses, near Hornsey Station. It can be easily seen from the neighbouring heights, but is of modern origin and only dates from 1888. It is built in the Gothic style of architecture and replaced an earlier structure dating from about the year 1500, which was pulled down in 1832, except the old tower, which still remains. In the churchyard is the tomb of Samuel Rogers, the banker poet, author of The Pleasures of Memory. The Pleasures of Memory by Samuel Rogers. Twilight's soft dews steal o'er the village green, with magic tints to harmonize the scene. Stilled is the hum that through the hamlet broke, when round the ruins of their ancient oak the peasants flocked to hear the minstrel play, and games and carols closed the busy day. Her wheel at rest, the matron thrills no more with treasured tales and legendary lore.
That was another reading from The Face of London by Harold P. Clun, and the reading there was by the wonderful Heidi LePain. We did a walk on Sunday from Clun's book. There are 25 walks in the book and 4 drives. The 25 walks, probably half of them, I'd say, are based around the City of London. And I think Clun is particularly good on the City of London. I think that's possibly where his major strength is, actually. I did a walk from this book a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, which you can read about on my blog, islingtongue.blogspot.com. And that was a walk where we started at Blackfriars Bridge and went through the city, and it sort of takes you along Queen Victoria Street, which is a street really I'd never really paid any attention to before, actually, before I read this book. And this book really opened it up for me. And it linked together other places around there that I'd seen before. I mean, and it gives lovely little details. Like, he talks about Barnard House, which is a sort of a really quite nondescript brutalist building on Queen Victoria Street, not far from Blackfriars Station. But, you know, he gives you the detail that this was the home to the first System X digital exchange, which is quite lovely. And he took us to places like the Barclays Clearing House, which was derelict when we were there. It was quite spooky. And this is 3 or 4 years ago before the crash. And also to the oldest coffee house in London, a sort of 16th century coffee house in St. Michael's Alley. And Nick, you've observed something about the way that Clun describes the city as it's experienced by the walker.
Yes, it seems to me almost as if the speed of the prose suggests more a camera mounted on the front of a car that's cruising along the main roads of London. Film is shot and then shown back to somebody later on, with Clun describing what is passing on the screen. It's most odd, and I think again it's because Clun is so focused on architecture that he doesn't really fill in the details in terms of what lies between buildings, certainly doesn't go into what lies behind buildings. He doesn't pick up on local atmosphere at all. He is more in a celebratory mood, describing the fine edifices that pass in the camera eye. It doesn't seem like a walking speed observation to me at all, Clun's prose.
No, I don't get the impression of a man that wrote that after having walked them out. I mean, the walk we did the other day starts at, well, we didn't do this. This is the route that Clun describes. It's the 20th walk in the book, and it starts City Road and goes through Islington, but then from Upper Street he both goes down Essex Road and across to Barnsbury and over to Caledonian Road. So I don't know how on earth one would do that whilst walking at the same time through Islington. And then he goes up through Highbury, but manages to simultaneously go along Highbury New Park, which runs down towards Stoke Newington, but also at Holloway Road towards the Nag's Head. That's difficult to do if you're walking. Difficult to do, I imagine, if you're driving. And from there, the route is a little bit more... from then on in, we were able to follow it quite closely. And we just walked from Highbury to Highgate in the end, which was, I think that's one of the best walks we've done in this series. Possibly because I think Clun gives your imagination room, because he's not imagining it for you. He's merely describing it. And I think that gave us more room for our imaginations to work upon that landscape and for memory to work upon the landscape. Was that the, and I think you were having a similar experience, Nick, as well, weren't you?
Well, I was observing you having the experience and very interested listening to you talking about how you came to London with your wife and lived in the area, because it doesn't actually have very strong emotional ties for me, any of the places that we walked through the other day, until we got to about Hornsey.
Yeah.
I mean, we went through Finsbury Park, and I did go to a Steve Hillage concert in Finsbury Park once. I think it was in about 1979. But I don't have particularly strong associations with that area, although my mother lived in Battledean Road near Highbury Fields when she was a very little girl. But it was very interesting listening to you talk about your memories of that area, and it was good to be carried along with that.
Well, Highbury Fields, for me, is one of my favourite places in London. If you were sort of doing that kind of quiz, oh, list your favourite places in London, Highbury Fields is definitely my favourite open space, I think. Because part of that is the topography of it, because it sits so high, unexpectedly high, you don't realise... You're on high ground, and I think it's one of the first times after you've ascended City Road or you've ascended the Penton Mound. It's the first point in which you really get a sense of being up high, and they used to do a wonderful bonfire on Highbury Fields. And then you can sort of see the flames licking up against the sky and the city sitting below, and which is a reversal, actually, of one of the origins of why that's a protected open space, because it's one of the places where people took refuge from the Great Fire of London. And I've heard it mentioned that that's one of the reasons why it's been protected, because it's built up all around Highbury Fields. We moved on from Highbury Fields towards the new Arsenal Stadium, and I'm going to play a little field recording now. Do you want to say anything before I play that, Nick?
I was surprised at how high the area was. Because I live on the northern heights, I tend to think of anywhere south of Hampstead or Muswell Hill as being, you know, the swamplands. These things all being relative, I didn't realise that there was actually a sizeable gully which holds the Holloway between Highbury Hill and the Northern Heights.
And here we are making that discovery, and we'll probably take you through to Crouch End with these little field recordings from the walk we did with following Harold P. Clun's The Face of London.
It's a great view there, Nick, isn't it?
Oh, wow, look over there. You can see... Highgate and Holy Joe's, the Catholic seminary. That's the Northern Heights there. That's the eastern edge of the what's basically the Hampstead Massif. And they cut the archway road through it and separated it off. Originally, the archway road, where the archway is, was a tunnel, and it collapsed.
Oh, okay.
They actually sliced right through the ridge of high land. But you see, can you see here? Look, if this is going downhill and it's going uphill there, what lies at the bottom?
Holloway.
And...
I don't know.
Streams. Hackney Brook, maybe.
A lot of water around here.
The Hackney Brook, maybe.
Yeah. I've never got a sense as well before of how Holloway sits in a hollow, but it's called the Hollow. I think the name comes from the Hollow Way to Highgate, whatever the Hollow Way to Highgate.
Well, hollow ways tended to be deeply cut lanes with trees overgrowing,
yeah.
Didn't they?
Yeah. So that's really striking, actually, isn't it? Really striking.
Yeah. What we can see here is the geological infrastructure of the London landscape, the thing that's usually screened out.
That's not part of your escarpment, is it, Nick, over there? That's not part of the North London tertiary escarpment?
That depends on whether I define it by 120 metres or 100 metres. I've decided to roughly define it by 120 metres so I can leave out the Northern Heights and the spits of land that form Totteridge and Mill Hill.
This now for me, I mean, we're going to descend now into the hollow of Holloway. And this is good topography for me, Nick, because I wasn't aware of that ridge rising up there, that view of Highgate and Muswell Hill and of the location of Holloway in the base of this kind of dip, this valley. And so it's discoveries like that that I really give me a buzz doing these walks.
Oh. I like to think that's why I'm on the team, John, to alert you to that sort of thing.
And thanks to Clun as well, you know, because he doesn't spell it out, does he?
Clun's not terribly interested in the geological infrastructure of London, although he does mention the Pinner Valley at one point, and I wondered where that was. And strangely enough, the night before we met Tim and went down to Roxeth, I couldn't sleep properly, and I had this sort of semi-waking dream where I was on a ridge northwest of Harrow-on-the-Hill, and I woke up and thought, you know what, that's the Pinner Valley I was just looking at. I always find this area redolent of the 1960s. I know it's not anything obvious.
I
don't know, it's a thing I imagined or invented, possibly, but I can almost feel these astral entities living in these houses. The back end of the swinging London, vegetarian revolutionaries, psilocybin sexologists, people who experimented with tantra or group sex, that sort of thing. I can just imagine it happening in these houses. Whereas now, what would they be into now? Reading G2 or something.
Probably the same. But this area was known for that in the 60s. It was a kind of New Agey area. I mean, I think people claimed it was built on the convergence of two ley lines.
Only two?
Consequently, you had big hippie community here in the 60s. And, you know, later on, that's why... Well, I don't know if that's why, but then you had a lot of musicians and stuff come and live here. Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics has his recording studio here, famously. And people like Bob Dylan would come and record.
Hence the famous story.
The famous story about him spending 3 hours in this old lady's house thinking it was Dave Stewart's house. It was full of kind of... It was a centre of sort of New Age mysticism, wasn't it? I think there's a little bit of that still around. Hey, this is great, yeah. What have you seen, Nick? This is like a...
Looks like a parish boundary stone. We're clearly looking into a river valley here.
Yeah, you're right. What river?
I think it's the Moselle.
Really?
Which is a stream that comes down from Queenswood, which is on the opposite side of the road to Highgatewood. And it flows down this way and goes all the way to Bruce Castle and then into the River Lee in Tottenham.
It flowed
through the Broadwater Farm Estate where the riots were in 1986.
Because that's a major valley there. That's not going to be a stream running through there. That's going to be a river.
Well, it'd be a... No, I think it'd be a stream.
Really?
Yeah, we're not talking about a lot of water.
What's on the far side of this valley? Because we're on the top of Crouch Hill and we're looking across and there's lights on the far hill. Across a pretty wide valley. What would that be over there, Nick?
I think we're going over towards...
Is that Alexandra Palace over there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, Crouch End is famously where a lot of Shaun of the Dead, classic British zombie film, was shot. There's a real undead riff running through here, isn't it? Because you've got the Highgate Vampire, the undead. You've got Will Self's short story, The North London Book of the Dead, which is about the undead.
You've got the whole mythos around David Farrant, which we're lapping up towards the base of.
Yeah, and then you've got Shaun of the Dead,
and Dennis
about
Nielsen.
Zombies, the undead, and Dennis Nielsen. Very much the dead, though, those people. Sad as that is.
Yeah, but he kept them around as... arguably, he kept them around as sexual partners for a period after he murdered them.
Yes, sir.
And he wanted their company.
You had an encounter with Dennis Nielsen, didn't you?
Yes.
As you met him once and he was rather fond of you, wasn't he?
What are you implying?
This is where I should play a clip from the film with Nick talking about it.
So I ended up in Wormwood Scrubs in 1976, March. I was sent down from the Middlesex Crown Court, held at the Middlesex Guildhall near Westminster.
Did you ever go back there as an adult, Nick?
Yeah, in 1983 I was in there with Dennis Nielsen, the serial killer. He was in the cell next to me. He gave me... I remember I was on this drug that used to knock me out every lunchtime, and about 3 days after he arrived, I dozed off on my cell bed. It was during association, so all the cell doors were opened, and when I opened my eyes, Nielsen was standing in my doorway looking at me. He wrote a poem about me called Silver Boy, He said the silver boy lies on his bed as if he's dead. Well, I reckon he was he crossed his mind to strangle me. It would have been a real coup in the media. You know, he's just been sent down for killing people and he's killed someone within days of getting his life sentence.
Hello, we're back here on Ventures and Adventures in Topography. That was Nick riffing about Dennis Nielsen as we skirted Cranley Gardens. We didn't go to Cranley Gardens, which I'm disappointed about. I would like to, I don't know what I expected to have once we got there, because you've got no connection with Cranley Gardens. You just happen to have had that experience with Dennis Nielsen. I mean, do you want to add to that, Nick, or would you rather not?
I have traced a stream down from Queenswood that runs down behind some of the houses in Cranley Gardens and flows east towards Tottenham. Dennis Nielsen, well, you know, I felt sorry for him, but I know what he did was awful.
One of his victims was from the village that I grew up in, and his father went to school with my father. So to kind of link it back there, if we were sort of dyed-in-the-wool psychogeographers, I'm sure we'd make a lot of that. What a powerful place, though, Crouch End. I mean, the mythology there is so rich, not just Crouch End and Hornsey. And I don't think it's coincidental that there's so much mythology attaches itself to that area. I mean, there's the things that we've already mentioned in those clips, but also Stephen King wrote a short story based on a walk that he took along the disused railway line, which is now, I think, called the Northern Heights Footpath, isn't it? And that inspired him to write a short story called Crouch End. And the legend of the Highgate Vampire, I mean, it's worth spending a few minutes looking into that. There's bits and bobs on the internet. We found a couple of great pamphlets, didn't we, in Prospero's books in Crouch End.
Mm-hmm.
Deal with it, written by David Farron. And I know there's another person called Cardinal Manchester, I think he's called Sean Manchester, who's written some stuff.
I remember David Farrant from my childhood. I don't mean through a personal meeting, but as an 8 or 9 year old in Finchley, we knew of David Farrant and we used to talk about him, possibly because it happened in Highgate and that wasn't really that far from where I lived. What I found interesting about the little booklet that you picked up from the bookshop in Crouch End, John, was the Hammer Horror imagery of the photographed rituals inside the book. All the occultists have got Brian Jones hairstyles, and the high priestesses have got silver crin hair.
It's lovely. But what I thought was interesting about that is that obviously there are people who are prone to believe in vampires and get caught up in that. I put something on Twitter about it, actually, and a number of people were getting excited about the possibility of a vampire, probably something to do with a film that's out at the moment called New Moon, I think, and True Blood that's on TV. But I think the other thing that makes it powerful is the atmosphere that lurks around that part of London.
Well, the Scarp, the Northern Heights Scarp, that far east, is far more... it dominates the landscape far more than it does at the Hampstead end of the Scarp. Hampstead is kind of quite soft and gentle in its shape, but there's something almost gothic about the hills rising to the east. The succession of hills, the one that contains... Alexandra Palace, but also the Crouch End Hills.
We could talk about this for a long time. There's many things I'd like to talk about from that walk, including Nick revealing that he has an almost encyclopedic knowledge of classical music, which came out when we troubled a lovely old gentleman in Stroud Green Road in a cafe, which led to a list of obscure British composers. Obscure to me, probably not obscure to people that know about classical music, but certainly this music teacher was incredibly impressed. We've got to do the admin now to round the show up. We've had a great time with you today. What do we have to do? We have to thank Hayley LePain, the wonderful Hayley LePain, for her readings. We have to...
Can I just say hello to my friend Miserable Michael? Well, you're right, Michael. There's just no point to any of this.
Miserable Michael and other people, please email us at deeplibrary@yahoo.com. The podcast of last week's show is now available from the Resonance website. We also have a website at venturesintopography.wordpress.com. Thank you to Sarah for doing the desk for us today most ably.
Thank you, Sarah.
And we'll be back with you next week. This show's repeated on Monday at 10 p.m. Thank you and goodbye.